An accuser spoke these words to Peter as he stood in the courtyard of the high priest while Jesus was on trial. Those who were around him suspected that he might have been a companion or disciple of Jesus. Peter did not want to be revealed as a disciple of Jesus. He was afraid of what they might do to him. After all, his Lord and Master was on trial. So he did not want to be identified as an associate of Jesus. And he was approached at one point, actually on the third occasion, and said, "Surely," the person said, "surely you're one of Jesus' disciples because your speech betrays you." Other versions render it in different ways. That's the wording of the New King James Version. Your speech betrays you. Literally, it is, your speech makes you evident. Apparently, the Galileans, and Peter was from Galilee, even though Galilee was not very far north of Judea or Jerusalem, nevertheless, in that region, they had a different dialect or a different accent, some way in which they spoke that was different from the people in the south of the country where Jerusalem was. And what this fellow was saying to Peter was that, "Listen, you're talking a different way. You talk like a Galilean, and we know the disciples of Jesus are Galileans, so you must have been an associate or disciple of Jesus." And Peter denied it. But there's an idea in there, in that statement, that is, your speech betrays you, that we need to pay attention to. Because actually that's true in a spiritual sense. Not only does our speech sometimes show that we're from a particular ethnic group, or we're from a particular country, or even a particular region within a country, our speech can also show what we are in terms of our moral character or our spirituality. So speech is a very effective means of identification. Sometimes we think we can identify people by, you know, their skin tone, where they're from or whatever, or the way that they dress in some cases can tell us where they're from. For instance, some women who come from, to give you an example, some women who come immigrating to this country from India might continue to wear, do we call them saris? I'm not sure, S-A-R-I-S, a particular distinctive ethnic dress. Some other countries have that too, although as the world becomes more homogenized in terms of dress, we're getting away from that. But, you know, it's hard to fake speech. If someone asked me, you know, "Start speaking like a British person," I could not do that. Now, some people can do that, but I cannot do that. Even someone who speaks native English as a native language, if he's non-American, you know, Australian or New Zealander or, you know, British or whatever, I cannot speak English the way that they do. So when we hear an Englishman here in the United States speaking, we know, "Oh, that person sounds like that person is from the British Isles. They speak with a different accent." You know, the other day I went to pick up my accumulated mail after I got back from the trip. I went to pick up my accumulated mail, which I had kept at the post office. I walked up to the postman and I said, "I'd like my mail, and here's my address," and so forth. And while someone else was getting the mail for me, he said, he just wanted to chat with me and said, "What part of the South are you from?" I get that quite a bit. Even though I've been living in New Jersey 28 years, I'm not offended by it. I just can't seem to shake my southern accent completely. But you ought to hear how some of my relatives down south talk if you think I've got a southern accent. But anyway, I just can't seem to shake it. And I teased him back and I said, "What makes you think I'm from the South?" There is a particularly illustrative example of this in Stephen Ambrose's book, D-Day, the 75th anniversary of D-Day, June 6th, which occurred June 6th, 1944. You know, the Normandy invasion during World War II is going to be, well, this June 6th, the 75th anniversary. And I'm reading a book about D-Day right now, and it had an interesting story in it that I think illustrates how distinctive speech can be and how it can identify people. When the Normandy invasion occurred, the first troops who went over were airborne troops or paratroopers. They parachuted in behind enemy lines. And they did this in the wee hours of the morning, June 6, 1944. And it was dark. And so when all these paratroopers got onto the ground and they got scattered to the four winds, so to speak, and they started looking for one another in the darkness, they had to have some way of identifying or distinguishing friend from foe because it was dark. So they came up with a couple of ways to do this. One was to provide the troops with clickers. They were called crickets. And they would, you know, when you came up to someone or you saw someone maybe a little bit off in the distance and wondering whether he was a German enemy or a friendly American, you would click once. Click, click. And then if that person was friendly, he would also have a cricket. And he would click back twice in response. Click, 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 click. Okay, we're safe. We can approach one another without fear. But to be on the safe side, they came up with another system of identification. They had passwords. Not just one, not just two, but three. There was a challenge word. Secondly, there was a password. And thirdly, there was a response. Now, the challenge was, when you saw someone, a dark figure in the distance, you would say, "Flash!" And that person, if he was friendly, then would say in response, "Thunder!" Now, you've got to imagine that possibly the Germans might have picked up on these challenges and passwords after a while, after hearing them, maybe. And so they came up with a third word. There had to be a counter response. And that was welcome. And the story is that they chose welcome because Germans could not pronounce it welcome. Instead, they would pronounce it welcome, turning the W into a V, just like I used to think the composer's name was Wagner. Until I found out the German composer's name is actually pronounced, looks like Wagner to me, but it's pronounced Wagner. The W becomes a V in the way the Germans pronounce it. So, welcome would be pronounced by Germans, welcome, and that gate would give them away. Well, there was a problem. One captain was approached by a Dr. Samuel Feller, who was a dental officer. And he had volunteered to accompany the assault echelon. He had a problem. Feller was a German Jew who had escaped Berlin in 1938. This is 6 years later, 1944. And apparently he has immigrated to America. He's with the Americans now. Or with the Allies in any event. And he came up to this captain, who was named Schettel, and he said, "Captain Schettel, what do I do?" Uh-oh, he had a problem. He couldn't pronounce what like what. It came out, what? Because he was German. He had not shaken his German accent. So he had a problem. The captain said, "Don't open your mouth. When you get to the ground, make sure you've got some extra crickets, you know, click, 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 click. And snap twice if you're challenged." Story goes that later, as Captain Schettel was inspecting each plane load prior to takeoff, he found Feller with crickets strapped to both arms, both legs, and an extra supply in his pockets. Very important to get the words right. See, in this matter, life and death hung on literally half a letter. There are also some biblical illustrations of this. For instance, there are the children of Ashdod. See, some Jewish men had married some foreign women from the city of Ashdod and other Philistine cities. And the children, even though they were supposed to be Jewish, they were growing up speaking a foreign language, the language of Ashdod. The way they spoke showed that their mothers were not Israelites. Then there are the Ephraimites. They were detected during a civil war or battle among the Israelites. They were detected because they could not say the word Shibboleth, S-H. When it came out of their mouths, they dropped the H. They could not say it. And it came out Shibboleth. They lost their lives as a result of that. Again, life hung on one letter. One little sound. Then there's the example of Jacob. You may recall this story, how in an effort to deceive his father as to his real identity and receive his father's blessing, he was disguised by having goatskins, hairy goatskins placed upon his arms, because his brother was evidently very, very hairy. And his father Isaac was blind or virtually blind, so he could not visually identify him, but he could feel him, he could smell him, and he could hear him. And it's interesting to note that he said, that is, Isaac, his father, said in Genesis 27, verse 22, you know, there's the smell and the feel, so to speak, of Esau, but the voice is that of Jacob. And Jacob was identifying himself to his father as Esau. But see, the thing he could not disguise was his voice. And that almost gave him away. So these are also biblical examples of the fact that our speech can betray us. But as I was suggesting a while ago, what we're really concerned about in this lesson is what our speech reveals to others and ought to reveal to us about our spirituality or our moral character. Is it what it ought to be? What? Let's ask ourselves as we proceed through this lesson. And I was amazed as I worked at this lesson at how many different ways we can offend in our speech. And we're going to hurriedly proceed through these then. After all, Jesus said in Matthew 15, verse 18, the things that proceed out of the mouth come from the heart. And therefore, we would be justified, I believe, wouldn't we be, in saying speech is the mirror of the soul. Your speech reveals who you really are. So maybe sometimes we need to stop and we need to listen to ourselves and ask ourselves, how am I speaking? And what does that reveal about me? The scriptures ascribe great power to the tongue. I won't read all of these. We really don't have the time for all of that. But I think one representative one I will turn to and read. And that is Proverbs 18, verses 20 and 21. I think this is very representative of the others. With the fruit of a man's mouth, his stomach will be satisfied. He will be satisfied with the product of his lips. Your lips, then, what you say, will determine whether or not you eat, in many cases. People have literally lost their jobs because they don't know how to speak. In verse 21, death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruit. The idea is if you love your tongue, you will train your tongue. You will be careful as to how you speak. Also, James said in James 1:26, and I don't have this on the screen or the PowerPoint, but it's important, so let me turn to it and read it with you, or to you. James there says, if anyone thinks himself to be religious and yet does not bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless. I've known Christians to do some great things, but they have trouble bridling their tongues or controlling their tongues. And what does James say about that? He says, if that's the case with you, your religion is what? Worthless. Those are strong words. What James is saying, in effect, is, listen, you may think you're doing all sorts of great things in the name of the Lord, or for the sake of your religious faith, but listen, none of that counts if you don't manage to control your tongue. He goes on to point out in James 3 that the tongue is the most difficult aspect of a person's life to control. Again, this is a long reading, so let me just bring it down to two verses. How's that? Verse 2. James says, for we all stumble in many ways. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well. That's like saying, you know, your tongue is the last thing you learn to control. You might be able to control your arms and your legs and every other part of your body, but the one that's going to give you the most trouble is your tongue. So that if ever you get to the point where you're able to control your tongue, you're a perfect man. And that should imply, if you can control the hardest thing to control, then you're able to control every other aspect or part of your body and life. Verse 8 also. He says, no one can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil and full of deadly poison. Imagine that. He says, and he's not saying that we shouldn't try to control our tongues or that we can't make a great deal of progress in doing so. But he says, no one can control the tongue. That's a scary statement to me. And I have been a Christian for decades, preacher of the gospel for decades, but I'll tell you, there are still times when I offend with the tongue. It's tough. It's tough. Hence the lesson this morning. We need to pay constant attention to our tongues and be careful about how we speak, because, as Jesus says in Matthew 12, verse 37, by our tongues, and I'm paraphrasing here, by our tongues we'll be condemned or justified, one way or the other. Our tongues will condemn us, or if we're able to control them, we will effectively be justified by our speech. Let me quickly now go through some various ways in which we might offend or sin with our tongues. And I emphasize quickly here. I'm going to try to be about as quick as I can because there are, well, a number of them. Don't mean to scare you, but there are a number of them. James 3, verse 1. If you're still in James, looking at verse 1 of chapter 3. He says there, let not many of you become teachers, my brethren, knowing that as such we shall incur a stricter judgment. We need to be careful about being teachers because we can fall into the problem of false teaching. We might not be careful about what we're saying. Sufficiently careful, we may teach something that is false. Now, this is kind of a hyperbolic way. Remember we talked about hyperboles of Jesus a few weeks, an exaggeration for effect. He says, because there are other passages that tell us we need to aspire to be teachers. Okay, but in order to impress us upon us how easily it can be to fail as a teacher and say something that is misleading and false, James says, let not many of you become teachers. Okay, let's move on. Still in James here, still in chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. Cursing can be a problem. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come both blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be this way. So, to curse someone is to wish or call down evil or misfortune upon them. Why is that a problem? Why would you want to curse someone? Why would you wish evil on someone? That is, even your enemies. We're taught instead to love our enemies and to pray for our enemies in Matthew the 5th chapter, Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. So cursing reflects a heart filled with contempt and hatred for our fellow human beings. Yes, they may anger us, but we do not want to respond by calling down God's curses upon them or something bad upon them. That's unworthy of a child of God. Find some other way to deal with it. Let's be careful about how we speak. You know, I've even had the instance of having, and this is, let me say that this does not refer to anyone here today or anyone who's a member of the church right now, but I've heard brethren use the word hell in a profound way. Even on one occasion in this building, and had to correct that person. I don't know, is it getting to the point in society where hell is no longer a curse word? I don't think so. Let's pay attention to how we speak. Vulgarity. Let's go to Ephesians 5, verse 4 for this one. Vulgarity. Paul there says, and there must be no filthiness and silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. Vulgarity. Vulgarity is speech whose subject matter is ordinarily reserved for special groups or special situations because it arouses feelings of disgust. Some people want to use what we might refer to as bathroom language in public, in situations where they should not. There's an appropriate time for discussions about, like with your medical doctor maybe, but ordinarily in typical social settings, that is not a subject for discussion. And it bothers me when people take situations that, you know, would ordinarily be reserved for something that is private or something that is special, and instead they use it all the time, and it becomes trivialized, it becomes a normal part of speech, and we wind up coarsening our morals. I appreciate the fact that in society sometimes, at least in the past, it has been this way. There are some lines that you do not cross. Now, I realize sometimes we draw the lines, or have in the past drawn the lines where maybe they shouldn't have been. During our trip, I remember mentioning to some family members that when I was in elementary school, some friends of mine and I actually had a serious discussion about whether or not the word pregnant was a curse word. Because you didn't talk about a woman being pregnant when I was growing up. So I guess from that I got it was my contention that pregnant was a curse word. But you might talk about a woman being with child, or more commonly, when I was growing up, expecting. That was the proper phrase to use. Now, I'm not saying pregnant is a curse word. I don't think that anymore. But I do appreciate the fact that people did appreciate that you know, we want to preserve some specialness even in our speech and keep certain things out of our language. There was a particular word, now two particular words, that, well, they referred to male and female genitalia that are now used in public speech. Until a certain point in the 1990s, when our president had some problems, those words were never used in public. They just were not used in public. But then something happened in his presidency or in the Oval Office. And then I noticed people started using that word. And for a while there, they wouldn't use the parallel feminine word. But now they've started using it. And it's troubling to me that we are getting to the point where we think we can talk about anything and everything And morals, I'm afraid, it reflects the fact and encourages the fact that morals are being coarsened. Silly talk is also mentioned here. There are those who have trouble being serious when seriousness is needed, and they overindulge in humor and silliness. They trivialize what is serious. And Paul, in the same passage, also refers to filthy, or what we might call off-color jesting. Some people seem to delight in joking about sexual matters, and this trivializes what ought to be kept private and special. And to use such language in a trivial way reflects a heart which does not treat sexuality with the seriousness and respect it deserves. And it may suggest to people that, listen, I'm open to doing things sexually that you might want to do. It bothers me particularly, not to justify men using this kind of language, but when I hear young females, unmarried females, using gutter talk, what we might call gutter talk about sexual matters, I'm thinking, if they'll talk this way, then what will they do? Gossip. In Romans 1:29, gossip is specifically mentioned as that which is sinful and will lead to death, spiritual death. It is very easy to fall into the practice of relating information which others have no business knowing, and which may hurt the reputation of others. Sometimes people use the expression, this is not gossip, this is the truth. Well, you know, you can gossip with the truth. There's not a distinction between truth and gossip necessarily. Gossip is truth, perhaps, that just does not need to be spread around. We need to be careful about that. In that same passage, Romans 1, I believe it's verse 30, although I've got Ephesians 4:31 mentioned here, slander is also mentioned. What is the difference between slander and gossip? Well, gossip may be the truth. It's just the truth that shouldn't be said. While slander, on the other hand, is harsh and abusive because it is untrue. Gossip, I mean, they may have the same effects, but gossip can be true. Slander is not true. And that would be the distinction between them. Those who would not curse a person will effectively do the same to them by hurting them and their reputations with slander. Blasphemy. Blasphemy is speech which is derogatory of God. It includes not only outright defiance of God and unbelief, but also any speech which tends to deprive God of the character and status that He ought to enjoy in the minds and the conceptions of people. In Matthew 12, verse 31, blasphemy is condemned then as a sin. Lying is condemned in Colossians 3, verse 9. Deception with speech is one of the most common and besetting sins. To hear some people, and this might be exaggerated depending upon how you would define a lie, but lying people, everybody lies every day according to some. Now again, that may, I'd like to think that's an exception. Rather an exaggeration. But I think we're all familiar with the fact that, again, depending on how narrowly or how broadly you might define lying, lying frequently goes on. And that's a problem because lying violates the basic trust human beings ought to have in one another and places them in one another's control in a very fundamentally unfair way. Without commitment to truth, life becomes untenable. I mean, think about it for just a moment. What if you couldn't believe anything anybody said? Now, they might be telling you the truth. They might not be telling you the truth. You go to your mechanic. You go to your doctor. Your doctor says, oh, you've got some dread disease. Or the mechanic says, listen, we're going to have to spend thousands of dollars to get this car running safely. And then you later on find out they told you a lie. You can't believe anybody. Telling the truth is important to life. Life will break down if we can't trust people to tell the truth. So let's not think lightly about lying as some people might. Then there is loudness. Now, would we have ever thought that people might actually offend in, or sin in this way? But yeah, some people can be loud, boisterous. In Proverbs 27, verse 14, it says, he who blesses his friend with a loud voice early in the morning, it will be reckoned a curse to him. Now, to some extent, we can all identify that. I mean, might not be talking, but, you know, people making loud noises. I mean, do you really want your neighbor mowing his grass at 7 o'clock in the morning?
No.
Or even earlier? So loudness can be a problem. A loud talker or noisemaker disturbs peace, produces stress. Noise is a stress producer. Then there's the problem of talkativeness. James 1 verse 19 says, we're to be quick to hear, but slow to speak. And that's not true of some people. Talkativeness represents a lack of respect for the privacy and the time and the knowledge of others. I say knowledge of others because, listen, if these people would be quiet more often and listen to other people, they might learn something. And some people have something better to do than to listen to what these people have to say and rattling on all the time. Some people don't want their privacy violated by phone calls. Now, I've probably told you here before that the phone has become maybe my least favorite modern invention. There have been times when I have felt like I wanted to take a sledgehammer to the phone on the wall. I mean, I have literally been in a situation, again, not talking about anybody here or anybody who's been here recently. So, rest easy on that point. But I can remember one time that I was talking on the phone to a person, and this person continued to go on and on and on and hardly gave himself a chance for a breath. And it looked like he was finally winding down. He was even starting to say, okay, I'll let you go, or words to that effect. And every time he would say something like that, oh, well, okay, I guess I'll let you go. Oh, but there's one other thing. And that kept going on for several times. He would say that. And I'm kind of ashamed to admit this, but I felt like I was almost on the verge of tears. And I was literally pulling at my hair. Let me off the phone. Please be quiet. Don't be offended, but, you know, if I don't always answer your... Well, no, I don't think anybody here is that talkative, right? So, okay. I'll try to pick up the phone if you call me. Then there's the problem of contentiousness. In 2 Timothy 2, verse 24, as an example, it says, God's servant is not to be argumentative. Some people are contentious. There are some who seem to love a fight or argument. You get the idea? You probably have this experience. So don't you get the idea that some people just want to be what we might call contrarian? In other words, they wait to see what position you're going to take, and so they will know to take the opposite position. Some people just like to argue to see if they can come out on top. Well, you're not going to win with people like that. So, those who are contentious are really, what they're doing is looking to validate or prove themselves as being right to themselves and to others. Hey, look at me, I've won the argument. You know why? It's because I'm smart, that's why. Then there is bragging. Proverbs 27 verse 2 says, "Let another praise you, and not your own mouth, a stranger, and not your own lips." Now, don't go around patting yourself on the back. You know, if you've done something good, then others should notice that and they should tell you. You know, you need that kind of encouragement. But people who boast feel the need for confirmation of their importance. Look at what I did. I'm good. I'm smart. I'm important. How do we know that? Because, well, I just told you. Look at what I accomplished. So, bragging is egotistical. And really, it becomes a form of disbelief. Why do I say it becomes a form of disbelief? Because if we've got God who assures us that we're important to Him and that He loves us, particularly because we've been obedient to Him, what greater form of confirmation than can you have? Well, if you've got God, then why seek for confirmation from people? Then there is complaining. In Philippians, the second chapter, verse 14, Paul expresses it in this way in condemning complaining. Philippians 2, verse 14. And there he says, "Do all things without grumbling or disputing." Do all things without grumbling. Another word for complaining. While complaining can be a way of releasing tension and anxiety, it can also be a way of avoiding the solution to a problem. But we're not going to resolve problems by complaining about them. You know, we might want to go to a person. Let me back up a little bit here. I can understand what we might think of as complaining to a mate or to a friend, because, as I said, that can sometimes help release tension and stress. I'm really not condemning that sort of thing. But eventually, after that's done, we need to get around, maybe listen to our friend, listen to our companion, listen to our mate, and say, you know, what can we do to resolve this instead of just letting it go on and on? Besides, complaining constantly can also get wearisome and discouraging to others. There is betraying confidences or divulging the secrets of others. You know, there are some times when, well, certainly when people ask us and when they ask me to not repeat something, well, we should not repeat that then. Okay? But sometimes, folks, even when we're not specifically asked not to say something, we need to be very careful about who we relate that information to, if at all. Say something like that. Just great discretion should be exercised. So in Proverbs 20, verse 19, it says, "He who goes about as a slanderer reveals secrets. Therefore, do not associate with a gossip." So this betraying of confidences involves betrayal of a person's trust. It can also be destructive to a person's reputation. To go be someone who is known well as someone, you can't tell that person something because next thing you know, it'll be all over the countryside. Do you really want to be known as that kind of person? I don't. Then there's taking God's name in vain. That is condemned, of course, among the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20, verse 7. To take God's name in vain, or in a useless way, or in a way that it was not intended to be used, means to use God's name or to call upon God for some other purpose than prayer, and in a way which does not reflect respect for God. It's very irritating to me, but people will loosely so often use OMG. It's so common, it's now been reduced to three letters. Oh my God, OMG. Here's something we need to think about. I mean, when we want to exclaim something, do we say, "Oh Lord, oh my God"? Think about that. Are we really praying on that occasion? Are we thanking God for something? No. We just want to express our excitement or our surprise. Well, that's not why the name of God is to be appealed to. That's a form of using God's name in vain. Let's not do it. Then there is flattery. See all these ways in which we can sin with the tongue? No wonder James said no one can control the tongue. James 3, verse 8. Proverbs 26, verse 28, with regard to flattery. It says there, a lying tongue hates those it crushes, and a flattering mouth works ruin. Again, in chapter 29, verse 5, a man who flatters his neighbor is spreading a net for his steps. A person who flatters will soon be recognized as someone who is trying to take advantage of others, and others will avoid him. Flattery is a form of insincerity. It's really a form of lying, because really the person is not meant, what a person who flatters is trying to do is not to encourage a person, but rather to gain an advantage with that person, to gain a favor. But he winds up hurting himself and others. We're coming down toward the end now. Let me mention that we can, just a few more, we can sin also by being offensive and tactless. Jesus said in Matthew 10, verse 16, you know, you go out as sheep and as doves. In other words, dove is very... Anybody here ever been attacked by a dove? Been hurt by a dove? They just seem to be... Or sheep, for that matter. I mean, those are really gentle creatures, aren't they? You feel no threat from them. Well, in the way that we speak to others, we need to try to be gentle and tactful. The Lord expects His people to take into account people's sensitivities and consider the approach that they take in speaking to them. The fellow who thinks he is entitled to speak the truth any way he desires, and we're told in Ephesians 4, I believe it is, I'm taking this off the cuff, but we're told, I believe it's in Ephesians 4, to speak the truth in love. That doesn't necessarily mean sometimes we can't be firm in the way that we speak. You can speak firmly and still speak lovingly. But certainly it implies that we should not try to be hurtful or insensitive in the way that we speak to others. The fellow who thinks he is entitled to speak the truth any way he desires, irrespective of considerations of tact, apparently does not care whether the truth finds its purpose fulfilled by being received into the heart and life of the individual to whom he speaks. And he doesn't really then have a respect either for that person to whom he's speaking or for the truth that he speaks. You see, it should not hinge upon the way that we talk, but upon the truth that we're expressing. And truth doesn't become more truthful if we shout it. False teaching or false witnessing also, that's condemned in among the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20, verse 16. False witnessing is, well, it's what we would call perjury today. It's a special form of lying. It is lying under oath or in the giving of evidence. Now, when you go to court, the reason they make you swear is because in that sort of situation, what they're saying is, listen, under these circumstances, you may get away with lying to your parents or lying to your children or lying to your friends or whatever, but if you lie in this setting, you can go to jail. Because this is serious. People's lives may be hanging in the balance here. You've got to speak the truth. So, false witnessing is a particularly vicious form of lying. It places people's lives and well-being in danger. The last one. And then I won't be so talkative. Silence. In Ezekiel 3, verse 18... we're warned that if we don't speak out to warn the sinner from the error of his way, and he's lost, his blood will be required at our hand. It is certainly a misuse of speech not to speak when it is crucial to speak, as when there is a need to clarify confusion or correct an error which threatens people's souls or well-being. To remain silent in such circumstances reflects a lack of love and respect for the truth and the souls that that truth can save. So you wouldn't think that we could sin, perhaps, in speech by just not speaking, but yes, we can. In conclusion, then, speech reflects what is truly in people's hearts. Perhaps better, as I said at the beginning of this lesson, perhaps better than any other characteristic, perhaps better than the way we dress, or certainly better than the kind of car we drive or the kind of house we live in or whatever. Our speech, let's pay attention to it. It behooves us then to consider our speech and ask ourselves, does my speech betray me as a character or as having a character which is unworthy of a child of God? How do I speak? It may be that there's at least one person here today who has considered how he or she has been speaking, or maybe some other aspect of his or her life. Maybe then that person recognizes, I may need to make myself right with God. I've got sins that I need to be rid of. Maybe you need to be rid of your sins by obeying the gospel of Jesus Christ, by being baptized into Him, after having confessed your faith in Him, after having repented of your sins. Maybe that you have done that, but since then, whether in your speech or in some other way, you've acted as if you were not a Christian, as if you had not made that commitment to Christ when you were baptized. If that is the case with you, we'd invite you to come forward and let your sins be known, that we might pray with you and work with you and encourage you. That's what we would like to do. That would be the purpose of a confession of your sins. Won't you come? It's together for your encouragement. We now stand and sing.